time, noon. Around noon Tuesday, Tom and Bob arrive at the warehouse to meet with Joe. They park their old car at the curb across the street to the north. Joe's warehouse is an old red brick building, about 6 stories high and a block square. Although largely windowless on the lower floors, the upper floors have regularly spaced openings, most made of glass brick. To the south are the vast Omaha Railroad marshaling yards. On the south side of the building, an old, infrequently used spur of track runs up to and past a long loading dock. An occasional freight car delivers heavy bulk goods. For the most part, however, deliveries are made by truck through wide doors on the east and west sides of the building. The doors are hinged steel plates that large electric motors raise and lower. Trucks drive in from the west and are loaded or unloaded in the large central area that is open to the second floor. Around the side of the second floor is a landing with metal railings and gates. Goods are brought to the second floor and assembled onto pallets. Overhead hoists on tracks raise and lower these to the delivery trucks below. Once loaded or unloaded, the trucks drive out the east door. On the south side of the warehouse are sliding steel doors to the railway loading dock. On the north side are a few offices and storage rooms off a corridor, at the end of which is Joe's office on the northeast corner of the building. The ostensible business of the warehouse is paper goods, all kinds, from napkins to corrugated cardboard. Joe inherited the business from his father and has run it for many years. His trucks range across most of the Midwest and beyond, making pickups and deliveries. Joe Smith is a pasty, paunchy, middle-aged guy with a fat wife with unrealistic social ambitions. Joe's personality is essentially that of a dirt lot used car salesman. He'll do anything for a buck so long as it doesn't involve any effort on his part. Joe is partial to plaid sports jackets, heavily patterned ties, and pants of a polyester look. About 10 years ago, Joe got into financial trouble and found that his only offer for a bailout came with strings attached. The drug cartel, expanding into the heartland, needed a more efficient delivery system. Joe's location and the territory his business covered made him an appealing recruit. To Joe, business was business. If someone wanted drugs, so what? That was their problem, not his. His job was distribution. He saw no reason to be concerned about what he was distributing. He was only interested in the terms. After a bit of negotiating, he took on a lucrative wholesale distribution arrangement, as well as control of the retail operation in eastern Nebraska and western Iowa. Joe prospered. A few well-chosen gratuities to the local police and the political establishment, and his problems are few. He's a pillar of the community. Crossing the deserted windswept street, Tom and Bob target a nondescript door about midway along the north-facing side of the building. Entering, they walk down an old hallway to an office at the far northeast corner. Joe's office is large, wood-floored, and painted in a faded, pale yellow. The walls are scuffed and stained. Joe's desk is a big old wooden executive desk. In one corner of the room is a small table with a coffee maker and cups. Several old wooden chairs are arranged around the desk. Near the door is an old-fashioned coat tree. Joe is sitting behind the desk, which is strewn with papers. An old computer is off to one side, and there's a fax machine on a small table to Joe's right. Now that Pete knows that Mike is in Omaha, he's filled Joe on what's happened and faxes a picture of Mike. Joe doesn't want to get involved, but has no choice. Tom and Bob take off their coats, gloves, and stocking caps and pile them on a table in the corner. "So what happened? Is Mike in trouble?" says Bob, as he and Tom sit on old chairs across the desk from Joe. "Oh, yeah. He's in one shitload of trouble. Jack caught him passing information to a cable news network. Seems Mike was a reporter. He was spying to do a news feature or something. Pete's people almost took him out yesterday over near Des Moines, but he got away. Did you see that story about the big train wreck in Iowa?" They both nod. "That was Mike. Pete's guys were chasing him, but he beat the train at the crossing. Pete's people weren't so lucky. Geez, we saw bullet holes in the back of his car. That must have been from the chase," says Tom as he looks to Bob, eyebrows raised. "Yeah, well, right now we need to find him. Take this photo and go to that club tonight and ask around. See if anyone saw him. Find out anything you can, okay?" "Sure, Joe, but we'll need some cash," says Bob. "We're broke, and I had to give the woman at the motel $100. Joe, raising his eyebrows, pulls out his wallet and counts out $600 bills and says, "And this takes care of the motel clerk, too." Bob scoops up the cash and says, "Sure does. Okay, you call Pete as soon as you know something. Got it? If you can find Mike, there's twice that amount. Understand?" "You bet," says Bob, and they get up and leave the warehouse and return to their faded, rusted-out old car across the road. Time, 1 p.m. After they leave the warehouse, Tom and Bob stop at a fast food place to get lunch. Picking up their orders, they go to the condiment island for napkins, little packets of salt, paper cups of ketchup, and packets of sugar for the coffee. Tom nods towards a table in a corner, away from prying ears, and says, "How about that one over there?" Bob says, "Looks good. You want any cream?" "Nah, just black." They take off their coats and pile them on a spare chair and sit down on opposite sides of the table. Bob dumps 3 packets of sugar into the coffee and says, "You think this might be our big chance to make some real money?" "Shit, I hope so. We've been doing enough crap for the past 2 years. It's about time." $600, man. That's not bad," says Bob. "Well, 500, really, you know. 100 of that was just repayment for the woman at the motel," answers Tom. "Well, anyway, seeing as how I only gave her 50. At least we won't run out of beer money tonight," says Tom deviously. "No, not tonight. At least I hope not. But for all I know, you might drink that place dry. Hey, you can down a few yourself, as I recall. So anyway, when do you think we should get to this ruined place?" says Tom. "I don't know. 8 or 9. What do you think?" "Yeah, I don't think there'll be many people there much earlier. Don't want to stand around an empty club drawing attention to ourselves. Speaking of drawing attention, how's your club hopping wardrobe, dude?" "Pretty shabby. So's yours, as I recall," says Bob sarcastically. "No, not shabby. Non-existent. Let's face it. The only club we belong to is the Goodwill Thrift Club, and we're both charter members. You want maybe to spend a little of that cash and go get some new shirts and jeans or something? You know, I think I would. Don't remember the last time I actually had a shirt with a real price tag on it. That sort of thing impresses the ladies," speculates Tom sarcastically. "You know, you gotta remove the tag when you wear the shirt. The ladies don't want to see tags dangling from the merchandise." "Oh yeah, but I'll take it off real careful-like so I can put it back on later." "Geez, don't be a jerk," says Tom. "Okay, big spender. We go try to look purdy. Just about anything would be better than our present sad state," says Bob as he turns towards a big clown-decorated mirror hanging on the wall near their table. Tom looks too. The harsh, dark outline of reality stares back at them. Bob leans over and scoops up some ketchup from the paper cup with a French fry and says, "You know, Tom, I didn't think things would work out this way when we got out of high school. I kind of hoped things would take a turn for the better by now." "They gotta, man. Things can't get much worse." "Oh, don't say that, man. You don't want to tempt fate. At least not where we're concerned." "Yeah, I guess you're right. We're on our own. There ain't no one gonna look after us anymore," says Bob, beginning to get a bit choked up as he thinks back on how bad their lives have been since they were 17. "Don't worry about it, dude. We'll get by. Things will be okay. You'll see." "Yeah, no problem. Just some onions and the hamburger, I guess. That's all." "Yeah, onions. Here, too. You got to finish those French fries?" "Nah, you take them," says Bob. "I guess you remember, back when we started high school? You remember that day my dad came by to school to pick me up?" "Yeah, I remember, dude. Don't talk about it." "Yeah, there I was. A couple of you guys just talking and doing nothing." "Yeah, I know. Leave it, man." And then, out of nowhere, he walks up and hits me. "Let it go, Bob. In the face, like an animal." "Hey, Bob, forget about it. He's not worth it. We need to focus on other things." "Yeah, other things." Tom remembers the day. It was brutal. In one quick stroke, Bob was humiliated and knew from then on he was on his own. For the both of them, life has been one sucker punch after another. Bob just got his in a real personal way. They finish eating in silence until Bob breaks the mood and says, "Okay, we're done. Let's hit the road." They get up and pull on their worn coats, gloves, caps, and scarves, head for the door, and step out onto a blast of cold wind. Jogging over to the car, they hop in and ride off to buy clothes. A short trip later, and they're in the parking lot of some generic strip mall and are soon picking through men's clothes at a discount store. Bob finds a dark shirt and casts a quizzical look towards Tom. "Yeah, that looks good. What do you think of this one?" says Tom, holding up a cheap red shirt. "Not bad. You might actually look presentable in that," answers Tom. They find a couple pair of nearly tight jeans and proudly head for the checkout counter when Bob spies some cheap aftershave and points it out to Tom. "Okay, just as long as you don't go wearing it around that motel room. You smell bad enough as it is." Bob whacks him and grabs the aftershave, saying, "You know, this might do you some good, too." He twists off the cap and sniffs it, and puts the bottle under Tom's nose, who sniffs it and says, "Okay, it's not that bad." They spend a total of $54.23, combined, and go back to the motel, hopeful. Time, 1:15 p.m. At Mulroon, after finishing off the pizza remains, David says, "Okay, it's time for the tour. You need to see this place under natural light rather than laser light. Are those birds I just saw over there? I saw some at the bar last night." "Yep. Todd had a pair of breeding canaries. They got loose, and, well, one thing led to another. Then the kids started sneaking in their own. Canaries, parakeets, damned if I know what they are. I have no idea how many there are now." As David speaks, Mike looks up and marvels as, in the beams above his head, an airy nation flies. Crowd downstairs treats them as pets. Most are totally tame and will land on your finger. They've become completely immune to the noise, and they've learned to sing along with the bands. Some of them will fly down to the stage and perch on the mics and chirp right along. I think they've figured out what an amplifier is. The place is becoming a freaking bird sanctuary. Neat. David's aviary and boozer. Now can we get back to the tour? "What are those things that look like antennas?" asks Mike, pointing at short black rods extending from several of the rafters. "Antennas. They're part of the Wi-Fi network." He leads them to the freight elevator. They ride down to the second level and disembark. David points Mike to the right as they get off the elevator. He gestures towards an otherwise nondescript, unmarked, solid steel door.